Okay, thank you everyone for coming. This is the second part in a three-part series exploring the problem of evil in Jewish thought. And I do want to start with the source sheet. And we're going to begin by recapping the problem of evil and also discussing and recapping what we spoke about last week. So you'll now hopefully all see the source sheet. And so just again, an important distinction to make. That I already spoke about last week between the personal problem of evil and the philosophical problem of evil. The personal problem of evil is when one is confronted by, you know, an unfortunate event, a difficult event, a traumatic event, and they wonder how could this have happened to them. That is a very important challenge, but that is not our focus. Instead, our focus is what's called the philosophical problem of evil, which is a contradiction between two premises, and the result of which is seemingly the non-existence of God. And so if you take a look at source number the box, which is the problem of evil. So we have our first premise, which I would say is Judaism 101, that an omnipotent and all-powerful, an omniscient, you would say omniscient, an omniscient all-knowing, an omnibenevolent, all-good God exists. That's pretty much what we would consider Judaism 101. The second is that evil or bad things happen that should be prevented by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God. So again, to recap the example I used last week to try and keep things as light as possible, I accidentally walked into those stone benches outside BIAV. Now it was last week. An omniscient God would have known I was about to walk into that stone bench. He's omnibenevolent. He knows it, you know, he doesn't want me to be hurt because being hurt is bad. And he's omnipotent, so he has the power to stop me from walking into that bench. And yet, nonetheless, it happened to me. And therefore, the only conclusion can be that this omnipotent, omniscient, I'm starting to confuse myself how to pronounce it now, an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent God cannot exist. That's the only conclusion. This is the philosophical problem of evil, the contradiction between God and evil. Both cannot exist in the world, so it seems. And so last week, we looked at the most famous responses to the problem of evil, theodicies, which essentially say the reason bad things happen is because it's not because evil exists. You're wrong. There's no such thing as evil. Instead, what's actually happening is justice. You are being punished. We say this in the second paragraph of the Shema. God punishes people for a whole variety of reasons with a lot of bad things. If you don't do the right thing, you will be punished. The problem, and again, if you've not yet heard the first year in the series, go on while you tour and listen to it, because we talked about this at length. But essentially, while that might be a good response to explain why I, you know, walked into the bench last week, I was being punished for something, it breaks down very clearly the second we consider statements such as the Holocaust happened because of the sin of Zionism. All of a sudden, we bristle against such a thought, or the idea that people suffer in this world, so to merit Olam Haba, and here evil is not evil, but it's almost a reward for people. And so we spoke at length about theodicies and their problems with them. One thing I do want to clarify from last week is that a theodicy does not necessarily know why the bad thing has happened, but it does know it has happened for a reason. And therefore, the bad thing should not be understood as a bad thing, but as something else. In other words, when you hurt, you know, you all walk into the stone bench also accidentally and hurt yourself, you don't need to know what the reason is. You just know that there is some divine reason why this has happened. Everything happens for a clear and specific reason. Ultimately, the philosophical merit of theodicies is pretty clean and tight. If we just deny evil exists, we remove the second premise from the problem of evil, and now there's no more a contradiction. God is causing the evil to happen, the bad things to happen, and he's causing them to happen in order to enact justice, in order to do these things that need to be done. Just to clarify, I did not walk into the bench, someone messaged. In jest, I know, but no, I did not walk into the bench again this week, though it still hurts. Also, because Kayla is at this wonderful age where she'll crawl up to me and she tries to like pick herself up by grabbing hold of my legs. And she literally grabs exactly where I walked into the bench. So constant pain whenever she runs up to me. It is what it is. So when we get to the problem of evil and the solution of theodicies, ultimately, as elegant a solution as it may be, it is deeply unsatisfying. Something else I was reminded of this week, which is really fascinating, which fits in with the fact that people often will explain evil as being something else, is, and you'll remember from the Shabbat Shuvah Drasha and other situations, I like quoting Oliver Berkman, who used to write for The Guardian, now he does his own thing. He had a fantastic article several years ago now, pointing out the just world bias. People want to believe the world is just. People don't actually like to think that there is true evil in the world. And the really disturbing result of this is around Holocaust Memorial Day, for example, you start to see more and more people advocating justifications for the Holocaust. Because people don't want to believe in rampant evil existing. People want to be able to explain these things away in some other way. So people will engage in a whole variety of anti-Semitic tropes in order to, oh, there must have been a good reason why this happened. And that's theodicies. You want to believe that there is a just world. You want to believe that there is a just God. And therefore, we must explain this evil away some other way. Again, we talked about it at length last week. And so I want to move on to two other solutions that we are going to talk about tonight. The first of which is probably best termed the anti-theodicy. It is the complete opposite of a theodicy. And in truth, we're going to look at a lot of sources. There's not so much to actually say about them, but there are a few interesting, you know, points to note nonetheless. And anti-theodicies are best summed up in the source we actually saw last week, the way I opened the and answer two should already be above source number one. But basically, anti-theodicies deny the conclusion. So if the problem of evil notes that God, evil exists and it should be stopped by an omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God, and yet nonetheless the evil exists, the anti-theodicy accepts the validity of these two premises. It does not deny the existence of evil, but almost insists there must be an answer. It's just beyond the understanding of humanity. And so take a look at source number one. This was the source we saw last week from the Gemara in Menachot. Amar Lefanav, after Moshe sees Rabbi Akiva, Ribono Shel Olam, Haritani Torato, you've shown me his Torah. Harini Schara, show me his reward. Amar lo chazor le'acharecha, go back, view Rabbi Akiva once again. God says, chazar le'acharav, Moshe goes back and he sees Rabbi Akiva, ro'eh, Ra'asha shoklin besarab makulin, they are weighing his flesh in a butcher shop. He's been murdered horrifically. Amar lefanav, ribono shel olam, zo Torah v'zo schora, this is Torah and it's a reward. God, this is what you do to the righteous. Amar la, shtok, be silent. Kach ala b'machshava lefanai, this is my decree. In other words, you don't know why this has happened, but it has done. This is the anti-theodicy. God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent, and evil exists, and yet we have absolutely no way of understanding that there is a way of explaining the two. We just don't know what they are. And so I want to present with you several sources where we're going to see this idea appearing. It should be noted, a recurring theme of Sefer Iyov, the book of Job, essentially has this notion, you know, at its core. Iyov, you know, suffers tremendously at the hands of God. I don't want to get into the theological ramifications of that book. But basically, Iyov's friends visit him and they present him with essentially theodicies to which Iyov has no patience for them. The book of Iyov is all about, you could argue, or at least a major, one way you could read it is as a giant anti-theodicy. That we know, the reader knows, the reason Iyov is being punished. The reason Iyov, sorry, is having all this suffering visited upon him. And no one else does. And that's essentially how these things work. Qohelet also has an anti-theodic strain. Qohelet accepts that, you know, evil exists, even though God is just. And so if you take a look at source number two, so this is, as you will see from the seemingly tantalizing title, but we're not really going to get into the topic that the title is actually, from Rabbi Wieda, one of the Rosh Yeshiva of YU. He is my Rebbe, and he is grappling with the title of the source, the title of the recording, Homosexuality in Judaism. He's grappling with a slightly different question to start with, which is essentially a theological one often raised, which is how could God create people who are essentially set up to go against what God wants them to do? Fine, we're not going to open that kind of worms, but where Rabbi Wieda goes is important for our purposes. The truth is that the question is an excellent question, he says. You can add it to the list of questions we have about how the Ribono Shel Olam runs his world. There are many, many questions. Human beings suffer in a way that seems grotesquely unfair. I have a whole host of questions to which I don't have an answer. But the Ribono Shel Olam's infinite knowledge compared to our finite knowledge is such that we don't have answers to all these questions. That's an anti-theodicy. There is evil. Evil exists. There is no way of denying it, and we should not deny it. But nonetheless, we also acknowledge, we also believe God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent. And yet nonetheless, there must be an explanation as to how these two things happen. It's just beyond our ken. It is beyond our knowledge. The problem of evil comes out of the assumption that God might not exist. That's essentially what it's set up to try and prove. The anti-theology just denies that outright. God must exist, evil must exist, and there must be some explanation. I don't know what that explanation is, but I'm confident that one exists. And perhaps one of the most powerful articulators of this approach is Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's The Source of Faith is Faith Itself. I know I do a lot of recommendations, but if you've never read The Source of Faith is Faith Itself, which I've probably recommended a whole host of times in a variety of contexts already, read it. It's an absolutely excellent essay. Rav Lichtenstein writes in source number three, regardless of what issues, moral, theological, textual, or historical vexed me, I was confident that they had been raised by masters far sharper and wiser than myself. And I should just add here, Rav Lichtenstein is in part grappling with how can the Torah command us to commit genocide against Amalek? That's the moral thing that bothered him here. Well, how can God tell us you have to wipe out all the men, women, and children of Amalek? That strikes him as wrong. And continuing reading Rav Lichtenstein, and if they had remained, these other minds who'd considered these issues, if they had remained impregnably steadfast in their commitment, so should and could I. I intuited that, his categorical formulations and imperial certitude notwithstanding, Rav Huttner, who was a major rabbi in America in the 20th century and a very influential rabbi in Rav Lichtenstein's life, Rav Huttner had surely confronted whatever questions occurred to me. Later, I felt virtually certain the Rav had, that's Rav Soloveitchik, his father-in-law, so that the depth and intensity of their service of God was doubly reassuring. In other words, what Rav Lichtenstein says is that you might be bothered by the problem of evil. You might be bothered by, you know, how can God command us to wipe out Amalek? But greater minds than you have also been bothered, and they must have figured it out because you watch them daven and they still really seem to believe in God. It's a fascinating answer. And again, it essentially is the anti-theodicy writ large. There are questions out there we don't know the answer to, but we are going to learn to live with the question. And that's the source of faith is faith itself, says Rav Lichtenstein, learning to live with the questions and get on with your life regardless. Okay, there's a bit more I want to talk about here. Because in and of itself, you may already find the anti-theodicy either incredibly satisfying or deeply unsatisfying in and of itself. What is fascinating is that it's often coupled with one of two different perspectives. One thing you can couple anti-theodicies with is with the personal problem of evil. So again, I made the distinction earlier and I made the distinction last week between the philosophical problem of evil and the personal problem of evil. The personal problem of evil is, and again, let's just keep it light. Let's not get too, you know, dark here, but, you know, something not good happens to you. Where do you go from here? Take a look at source number four. Rav Soloveitchik in Kol Dodi Dofek, Fate and Destiny, his famous speech says, when a person suffers, he says in his heart, there is evil. I do not deny it. And I will not conceal it with fruitless casuistry. I'm not going to pretend it doesn't exist. I am, however, interested in it from a halachic point of view. I ask a single question. What should the sufferer do to live with his suffering? And slightly more easier to read, perhaps, even though if it's longer, is Lord Sachs, who says the same idea and Google Letters to the Next Generation, Jonathan Sachs. It's all available online and it's absolutely incredible. It would have been one of the things I would have printed out and handed out to the shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, except there was a limit to how many forests I was willing to destroy in terms of giving people printed material during the Yamim Noraim. But Lord Sachs writes, the oldest question in religion is, why do bad things happen to good people? And I just want to add here, because we are coming up to the first Yahrzeit of Lord Sachs, what no one knew is that for most of his life, he was suffering with cancer. And he was, so there. This source here gains an extra power when you realize there is an autobiographical element to this answer, to this source. But he asks, he states, the oldest question in religion is, why do bad things happen to good people? But there are two ways of asking this question. The first is, why has God done this to me? Never ask this question, because we will never know the answer. God cares for us, but he also cares for everyone and everything. We think of now, God thinks of eternity. We could never see the universe from God's point of view, so we will never find the answer to the question, why me? That's an anti-theodicy about as well articulated as you could find. But there is another way of asking the question. Given that this has happened, what does God want me to learn from it? How is he challenging me to grow? How is he calling on me to respond? Asking it this way involves looking forward, not back. Why did God do this is the wrong question. The right one is, how shall I live my life differently because this has happened? When I hit my legs on the bench last week, there's no point asking why has God done this to me. What I should ask is, says Rav Soloveitchik and say Lord Sachs, how do I live my life differently because this has happened? The answer there is very easy. Don't look at my phone when walking around, B-I-A-V. That's a very simple answer. But seriously, psychologists talk about this a lot. And I remember there was a very prominent psychologist in the Orthodox world, Dr. David Pelkovitz. He's a very prominent psychologist as a whole, but he's a very observant religious Orthodox Jew, and he teaches pastoral psychology to smicha students at YU. And he puts a lot of emphasis in the idea of always asking, you know, where do I go from here? You know, you never think of yourself as being stuck. You think of yourself as being positioned. It's kind of like psychology 101, how to navigate challenging situations. This is what you do. And essentially, the anti-theodicy allows you to pivot away from the actual question of how has this happened and into where do I go from here? Because it will never give an answer to why has this happened to me? It doesn't know of one. It cannot conceive of an answer. And so instead it asks, where do you go from here? And so one way anti-theodicies can work nicely is in helping someone confronted by the personal problem of evil and adapt to the pain they are currently experiencing and move towards a better psychological perspective on what they've currently been visited with. The other thing you can couple anti-theodicies with, and this is going to sound kind of crazy, is theodicies. Because a theodicy is confident there is a reason for why something happened. So why did I hit my, you know, legs on that bench, that stone bench? Well, I was being punished for something. What happens when you start to get into really, really big questions, like why did the Holocaust happen? Well, that's when you bring out the anti-theodicy. I can't explain it anymore. I don't know. And so as much as anti-theodicies and theodicies oppose one another, you will often find people who are so happy to go the theodicy route for the small things, instantly bringing out the anti-theodicy as a solution to the big things. And the truth is, as I said, when it comes to theodicies, you don't necessarily know what the reason is. You just know there's a good reason. And anti-theodicy also is kind of believes there's a good reason. It just doesn't know what it is. The two are perhaps not as distinct as we might think. Ultimately, it is very hard to philosophically assess the legitimacy of the anti-theodicy because it doesn't do anything with the problem of evil. I'll scroll back up to the problem of evil. All it says is, yes, premise one is correct. Yes, premise two is correct, but I refuse to accept the conclusion. Philosophically speaking, that's not really something you can do. But you can do it theologically. You can do it in your own personal life. Philosophically, that's not something you're basically allowed to do. That's like 1 + 1 = 2, 2 + 2 = 4. But I, you know, refuse to accept general math. That was a terrible analogy. I don't even know why I started doing it. But anyway, the point is, anti-theodicies, philosophically speaking, don't really have much merit because it's at the end of the day, it's the believer's refusal to accept the problem of evil's conclusion. But their merits lie in this being the first religious response we've seen that actually validates the existence of evil and also recoils from it, is still not happy about it. Evil does exist and we don't like it, but we just have to kind of move on and kind of get past it. Ultimately, it's a refusal to grapple with the question. And so if you were challenged by an atheist with the problem of evil and you brought up an anti-theodicy, you've not really done much. You've just essentially stuck your fingers in your ear and refused to face the challenge. And so while anti-theodicies may have some strength when it comes to the personal problem of evil, philosophically, as popular as they aren't really grappling with the philosophical problem of evil. And the truth is, none of these sources I quoted are pretending to grapple with the philosophical problem of evil. They are all talking about the personal problem of evil. Rabbi Wieder is addressing the challenges someone might face. Rav Lichtenstein is addressing the challenges he faced. Rav Soloveitchik is addressing, it's really his response to the Holocaust. How can Judaism recover, as it were, from the Holocaust? And Lord Sachs, again, is kind of advising people to take a certain mentality when it comes to personal issues with the problem of evil. No one here is arguing for a philosophical solution. Anti-theodicies best exist as solutions to the personal problem of evil, but are philosophically not so meritorious. The next type of solutions to the problem of evil I want to talk about is what's called the non-traditional response to the problem of evil. So first, what we're going to talk about for the rest of this evening and also next week is what we would now call a defense, as opposed to a solution to the problem of evil. Theodicies are a solution to the problem of evil. Evil does not exist, and therefore this entire problem, I realized I just waved at the screen and no one else saw me waving, but this entire problem in the box, if evil doesn't exist, if it's now justice, the problem of evil is solved. Anti-theodicies, they don't really solve it, but they just kind of erase the entire thing. A defense is not necessarily, we're not going to solve and offer a solution to the problem of evil. But just as a lawyer might offer a defense in court and cast suspicion, cast doubt in the judge's mind that maybe events aren't quite as clear as they seem, so too, be it the non-traditional approach or the free will defense, which we'll talk about next week, are not necessarily going to overwhelmingly solve the problem of evil, but they're going to complicate the way we think about it enough as to lead us to question the legitimacy of the conclusion of the problem of evil. The non-traditional approach. And I should just add, when it comes to non-religious circles, the non-traditional approach is a solution. But in the religious world, the non-traditional approach, which, as you can, you know, guess by the way, the fact that it's called the non-traditional approach, not necessarily the most amenable to a religious audience, but that's where it starts to become used as a defense. And what we are now going to do is we are going to explore a few different ways of actually questioning this first premise. When we say that God is omnipotent, that he's all powerful, when we say that God is omniscient, that he's all knowing, we're not going to get into omnibenevolent, that he's all good. What does it mean? What does it mean that God is omnipotent? What does it mean that God is omniscient? And perhaps if we seek to better define or redefine what these terms are, then we can be left with a defense of the problem of evil. We can actually allow God to exist in a world in which evil also exists if we now have a different perspective on omnipotence and omniscience. And so I want to first look at omniscience. And this is one of my favorite, and I mentioned last week, I think the reason I love talking about the problem of evil in part is because it's a window into talking about some other major philosophical issues. And this is probably my favorite of all of them to talk about, which is when we say God is all-knowing, and what does that actually mean? And what I want to focus on, and we're not going to read it straight away, source number 6, is the fascinating view of Ralbag and Gersonides. The Ralbag is a Rishon, he's a medieval rabbi, a somewhat influential one, and he definitely was a monk. We spoke about last year at some point medieval Jewish philosophy and how it was, you know, attempting to understand the religious world in light of Aristotelian thought. And the Ralbag is really fascinating. He was also very much an astronomer, so much so that it's actually, you know, he has a crater of the moon named after him, and it was done by Israeli scientists. It turns out when you actually read through some of his astronomical works, he was actually getting a lot of the astronomical ideas before, you know, they are believed to have kind of come into the world. So, you know, he was a very, very brilliant man and a very, very brilliant rabbi. And he grapples in fascinating ways with the philosophical challenges that are raised by Judaism. And he completely understands God's omniscience, his complete knowledge, in an entirely different way. To understand the Ralbag's understanding of God's omniscience, we first have to recognize something about statements. Some statements can have a truth value. Other statements cannot. So, for example, my name is Mark. That's a truth value statement. It is either true or false. That is how it is. The address of BIEV is 8800 Antioch Road has a truth value. It's false in this particular case. It's not that I don't know the address of my own shul. There are some statements that have a truth value. They are either true or false. We would call these facts. In contrast, consider the statement, cheese is delicious. Now that is, nowadays we'd call that an opinion. There is no truth, there is no objective truth value to that statement. Whether or not, you know, we all agree that cheese is delicious and we should, but nonetheless, there is no truth to that statement. It's an opinion. That's basically how it works. Two types of statements. Statements with a truth value, statements without a truth value. Facts, opinions. Knowledge revolves around truth value statements, not opinions. So first of all, when we say that God is omniscient, what we mean is that God knows the correct truth value of all statements. You don't. You do not know the truth value of a whole host of things. None of us do. God does. However, God knows absolutely nothing about the deliciousness of cheese. Because that's an opinion. God doesn't know these things. Because that is not within the realm of knowledge. There is, and this is already, we're not even getting into Ralbag's controversial point here, but this is just kind of omniscience 101. When we say God is all-knowing, definitionally, he can only know things that are knowable. Things that are unknowable, how many blocks are in a blue, God doesn't know either, because I just made that up. That's not something God knows. God knows the correct truth value of all statements that have a truth value. Okay, nothing too controversial here, even if it kind of goes against the way we traditionally think of omniscience, but this is probably the first time we're ever articulating it and trying to define it. Nothing actually controversial here so far. God does not know whether cheese is delicious. And if you were to ask any, you know, rabbi that question, honestly, if they say God does know whether cheese or not is delicious, I would ask a lot of follow-up questions, or maybe just turn around the other way and run. Okay. Here's where things get tricky. There are some statements that currently do not have a truth value, but will at a later point in time. Tomorrow afternoon for us, Manchester United are playing Atalanta, an Italian team. Manchester United will win that game. As of Tuesday evening, 8:34 p.m., that is an opinion. There is no truth value whatsoever to that statement. However, tomorrow at around, I didn't actually check what time the game was, but let's just say around by at the very latest 4:30 p.m. tomorrow afternoon for us, that statement will have a truth value. Manchester United will either have won or they will not have won, and therefore my statement will be true or false. You know, person X will win the election in 2024. Currently an opinion. If you were to state with confidence who will win the election in 2024, you are just stating an opinion. But come, you know, maybe like 8 months after the election, you know, it'll take a while for whatever, but eventually there will be a truth value to that statement. There are some statements that it turns out have a conditional truth value to them. My name is Mark has a truth value to it. It's either true or it's not. Cheese is delicious has no truth value whatsoever. God knows what my name is. Whereas, you know, random strangers I walk past don't. Or to put it another way, God knows the truth value of my name is Mark. God has no opinion whatsoever on cheese is delicious. What about Manchester United will win the game tomorrow? Ralbag believes something absolutely fascinating. Take a look at source number 6. The fact that God does not have knowledge of which possible outcome will be realized does not imply any defect in God. May he be blessed. For perfect knowledge of what the thing is in reality, hence God knows these things in the best manner possible, for he knows them insofar as they are ordered in a determinate and certain way. God knows the truth value of statements only when they have a truth value, says Ralbag. And I don't want to get into the fact that Ralbag clearly believes God is in time. A lot of other Jewish philosophers believe God is outside time. For Ralbag, God is in time. It's an important point to make. God does not currently know whether Manchester United will beat Atalanta tomorrow. He does not know the truth value because it's not happened yet. The difference is, the second the referee blows the whistle to end the game, whereas you won't be any of the wiser, and I might not be any of the wiser either, the second that whistle is blown, God knows the answer. It's kind of like Wikipedia and the Oscars. If you ever check Wikipedia during the Oscars, it takes them like a split second, and they already start telling you who's won. That's Lahavdil Elef HaBalot. That's essentially God. The second a truth value comes into being, God knows it. You don't. You don't know. You know an incredibly small number of truths. You don't know right now. None of us, I should stop saying you, it includes me too. None of us know the truth value of most things, the correct truth value. God will know all the correct truth values to all statements, but they have to be in play as statements with a truth value. And it's really important for the final line, for he knows them insofar as they are ordered in a determinate and certain way. You know, one of the famous ideas of philosophy is none of us actually know the sun will rise tomorrow. We believe it, but we don't actually know for certainty the sun will rise. A lot of things admittedly would have to go catastrophically wrong, but we don't know. God does. God can also know the truth value of the mechanisms of the world, if that makes sense. He knows whether the sun is truly going around, whether the earth is truly going around the sun. He knows these things, but he does not know things that have not yet happened. And thus Ralbag says, the fact that God does not have knowledge of which possible outcome will be realized. God does not know right now what's going to happen between Manchester United and Atalanta. Does not imply any defect in God. Because that's not how Ralbag defines God's omniscience. Omniscience, says the Ralbag, is God knowing the correct truth value to all statements that have a truth value. And that, yes, Andy.
So obviously there's a lot of context around these couple of sentences from Ralbag. When he says God knows these things in the best manner possible, does that mean kind of what you say, that he goes from not knowing, like all of us don't know, until instantly knows the truth value when it becomes a fact?
Yes, he knows them correctly.
Or could this mean, is Ralbag implying that, as we all know, we all have an idea of the probability that Manchester is going to win or the other team is going to win, and God has the best perspective and knowledge of how these things are likely to unfold?
No, I think it's the former, that he knows with certainty what happens the second it happens. One would also assume God is very good at probabilistic thinking, but no. But omniscience here means he knows the truth value of statements. And therefore, this is an incredibly elegant solution to the problem of evil. I scrolled up, by the way, and I realized I did that very quickly. No one else was prepared, and you may have got motion sickness from your screen suddenly rapidly moving. But what happened now last week when I walked into that stone bench? It turns out God didn't know I was about to walk into the stone bench. None of you knew I'd walked into that stone bench the second it happened. The order of people who knew I'd walked into that stone bench, me, because it happened to me. And at that exact same time it happened to me, God. A few seconds later, Elisa, because she was in the office and I was complaining to her. And then a few seconds later, Ruthie, because I was complaining that she was the cause of the reason I was looking at my phone. And then the rest of you, if you signed on to this share last night or you listened to it later, you learned most people in the world. I know it's a big ego. It's a big hit to my ego to know this. Very few people in the world actually know I hurt myself last week. And even though I keep on repeating it in this share, nonetheless, very few people are going to know. But God knew. Everyone in the past week who's had a similar, minor injury, God has known that has happened the second it's happened. But crucially for the problem of evil, God wasn't able to avert it because he didn't know it was about to happen. And that's not a deficiency in the way God works, because that's when we say, and this is such an important idea to digest, when we declare God is omniscient, we need to replace what we have always assumed to be true with a better definition of his omniscience. And therefore, it's not a deficiency in God for him to not know the impossible. And the fact that God can't see into the future, according to Ralbag, solves the problem of evil because God cannot prevent it. Alternatively, we've had a few questions. Oh, so God makes promises to Abraham. So it's a great question, and it's fascinating, and I don't know explicitly how Ralbag would answer it, but I could imagine God's promise is would work more along the axes that any of us make promises. As in, God will give Abraham wealth. He still has a lot of power to do that. He just can't lie. As in, the assumption that all of these promises will be made to Abraham, we assume mean he's already taken care of it sometime in the future. As opposed to, God is still omniscient and omnipotent enough, which is still very powerful, instead infinitely powerful, to make sure the dominoes are always lining up. I think that could be one way you would answer God's promises to Abraham can still be fulfilled with a God with this level of omniscience. What I do also want to say, and it's always said of Rambam, and if it's said of Rambam, how much more so Ralbag, because Ralbag makes Rambam seem like a very like uncontroversial philosophical figure. Rambam will reread every biblical story if he believes there's a philosophical truth behind it. So famously, and I've said this, you know, a lot of times because it's a very fun thing to talk about, Rambam doesn't believe angels exist. So he rereads all of the stories involving angels in a whole variety of creative ways. Ralbag, too, maybe his answer is just reread the story some way or another. So Zoom user, unclear who Zoom user is, but Zoom, mystery Zoom user. Oh, Frank, hello. Hi, Frank. Would God, oh, I see it right there. Would God not have had a plan at the creation for the ultimate presence of us? At that time, we were not a current issue. So now you're kind of getting into what we're going to talk about next week. Because some of what we are going to talk about next week dovetails with the question of omniscience. But again, God can have a plan. An omniscient God that knows the truth value of all statements is still omniscient. He still knows everything. He just doesn't have any opinions on cheese. And that I think is the point, is that we assume a more harder to comprehend level of omniscience. What God's omniscience almost does, according Ralbag's view, is he translates it into a way that humans can, that still works on the same axis as human knowledge. The way we typically understand omniscience is that it transcends human knowledge into understanding things we can't even comprehend. Ralbag would say otherwise. But next week, what we talk about next week might dovetail better with your question. So hold on to it for next week, where we may be able to have a, you know, some sort of answer, or at least a perspective that will work with your question. Another way of challenging the problem of evil is to question what we mean by God's omnipotence, that he is all powerful. So one thing that I don't want to dwell on, but at one point in the recent past, I went on a rant at this during, I think, you know, a Q&A. Omnipotence does not mean God can do the logically impossible. Similar to the omniscience thing, you know, the classic thing is, can God make a rock so heavy he can't lift it? The answer is, that's a nonsense question. Omnipotence does not mean he can do the logically impossible or the metaphysically impossible. Omnipotence does not mean God can fit, you know, 1,500 bleagons into a blah, blah. That's nonsense. God cannot do nonsense. He cannot make a square circle. He cannot make a rock so heavy he can't lift it, because that's not omnipotence. That's nonsense. Omnipotence means God has, you know, complete power to do the logically possible. It is logically possible to split a sea. So therefore it can be done. It is logically possible to rain lightning down from the skies, so it can be done. It is logically possible, anything within the realms of the and or the metaphysically possible can be done. Related to this are tricky questions like, can God lie? Because if God can lie, then we have problems. Because he's told us, he's made a lot of, as highlighted by the question to Abraham, if God can lie, then we have a lot of problems. But anyway, there's the white lie, the famous, you know, Rashi at the beginning of this week's parasha, God can white lie, but that's different. We don't need to get caught up in those kinds of questions. The question becomes, is there a way from within traditional sources to argue for a redefinition of God's omnipotence? And so this is where we get into a really, really fascinating grain of thought, which actually begins with the opening verses of the Torah. Source number 7. And what I want to highlight is the fact that if we were living at the time of the giving of the Torah, we would read these opening verses very differently. V'ha'aretz haita tohu vavohu. It was unformed and darkness. V'choshech al pnei taham. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. V'ruach Elohim, and the spirit of God, merachefet al pnei hamayim, was sweeping over the water. V'ya'as Elohim et harakia. God made the expanse. V'yavdel bein hamayim asher mitachat l'rakia, and separated the water. Above, uvein hamayim asher me'al l'rakia, sorry, below, and then above, v'yihi. Important to realize, in the ancient world, they believed that the skies was also a body of water. The firmament is like picture, essentially a transparent globe holding up the seas above. And that is what the beginning of the Torah is describing. The whole world is water. And the first thing God does is he divides the water into top and below. And then eventually land's going to come and yada, yada, yada. There is something very interesting here, which is the fact that water seems to, and again, classic commentators essentially freak out about this, because water seems to exist before God creates the world. It seems to be around. And if you were an ancient, if you lived in the ancient world, water would have a very different connotation, because water was very often an agent of death. Water was what drowned you. Water was what flooded you. Water is bad. And this, and particularly yam, we use the term yam to mean sea. And that's a very conscious word the Torah uses, because yam in the Torah is merely it's a body of water. However, Yam in the ancient Near East was the sea god, and he was the agent of evil. Yam was bad. And it's interesting because the Mayim, the water, seems to exist, you know, before creation begins. Not sure exactly what that means, don't really ask me. But nonetheless, you know, and we know this because God says, let us make man in his image. There seems to be these other beings that exist, you know, before things are created. We're kind of used to this idea, even if it runs against everything we think we believe. And a major motif that we find in a surprising number of Tehillim, we find in a surprising number of statements of the Nevi'im, of the prophets, is God battling with either the sea or creatures of the sea. And this leads in source number 8, John Levinson. John D. Levinson is an academic. He happens to be, he is an observant Jew. He happens in an Orthodox shul. You would happily eat in his home. But he's a scholar at Harvard. And his world is much more the academic study of things. And in his book, Creation and the Persistence of Evil, the subtitle of which is The Jewish Drama of Divine Omnipotence, he says the following. The survival of the tamed agent of chaos, whether imagined as the sea, Leviathan, or whatever, points to an essential and generally overlooked tension in the underlying theology of these passages. On the one hand, God's unique power to defeat and subjugate his adversary and to establish order is unquestioned. The Torah, remember, presents God dividing the water, dividing the sea, which is something that to an ancient person would have been, you know, known as something terrifying, God has this tremendous power to just separate it. On the other hand, those passages that concede the survival of the defeated enemy raise obliquely the possibility that his defeat may yet be reversed. One can argue, and again, now you know why they call it the non-traditional approach. One could argue from a whole host of, from a very non-traditional approach, that God's omnipotence does not preclude evil breaking out. Because evil is its own entity. Evil is a conquered being, a defeated being, not a destroyed being. Evil exists. And argues John Levinson, and you can argue in a very non-traditional way, and Creation and the Persistence of Evil is not a traditional book, quite the opposite. But you could argue that you could point to various passages within Tanakh that would seem to imply that evil has the power to break from God's omnipotence. And it doesn't necessarily destroy the notion of God's omnipotence. It's just built into when we say he's all-powerful, he nonetheless has evil kept behind a jail cell with very poorly constructed bars. And the truth is that I happened to be reading Creation and the Persistence of Evil many, many years ago, when I was also doing my master's at the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at YU. And I was doing a class on Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy. And I was also reading Halachic Man. And I stumbled across a passage that struck me in Halachic Man. Rav Soloveitchik writes the following in source number 9. When God engraved and carved out the world, he did not entirely eradicate the chaos and the void, the deep, the darkness from the domain of his creation. Rather, he separated the complete, perfect existence from the forces of negation, confusion, and turmoil, and set up cosmic boundaries, eternal laws to keep them apart. Now, Judaism affirms the principle of creation out of absolute nothingness. Therefore, the chaos and the void, the deep, the darkness, and relative nothingness must all have been fashioned by the Almighty before the creation of the orderly, majestic, beautiful world. However, the forces of relative nothingness at times exceed their bounds. They wish to burst forth out of the chains of obedience that the Almighty imposed upon them and seek to plunge the earth back into chaos and the void. It is only the law that holds them back and bars the path before them. However, this relative nothingness is plotting evil. The deep is devising iniquity, and the chaos and void lie in wait in the dark alleyways of reality and seek to undermine the absolute being, to profane the lustrous image of creation. Chaos and void, tohu vavohu, all of these ideas, Rav Soloveitchik cottons onto the idea that these are describing something before the creation of the world that have negative connotations. Chaos and void, it's kind of obvious that these are not positive forces. And while Rav Soloveitchik does not go as far as John Levinson for obvious reasons, the idea that there exists evil actually as an independent entity that has some sort of ability to break past or be released by God for one reason or another is not beyond the realms of Jewish theology. I mentioned last week, because it comes up more in theodicies, the notion that once God sends out the angel of death, it doesn't discriminate. The idea that evil can get out and wreak is not beyond theology. This also solves the problem of evil, or at least offers a defense. Because now, I didn't break my leg. That would be very dramatic. When I hurt my legs on the stone bench, it was evil. But you know what? It's not necessarily, from a Torah perspective, God's omnipotence does not deny the ability for evil to sometimes sneak out the back door when God's looking the other way. It can happen in minor ways. It can happen in major ways. But again, perhaps when we talk about God's being omnipotent, all-powerful, it does not preclude some sense of evil entering the world. That does not mean God doesn't exist. It does not mean God's omnipotent. It just means that there is some sense of evil that for one reason or another, Tanakh does not ascribe to God, but does not call into question his omnipotence. You can see the obvious merits with the non-traditional approach. If the atheist corners you in the supermarket and is like, how can an omniscient God, you know, prevent evil? You can easily turn around and be like, well, what do you mean God can stop it? Well, maybe he doesn't know that that's happening. It's not beyond the realms of Jewish tradition to believe that God can't see into the future. And then you start quoting the Ralbag at them and then they run away because they didn't want to do this anyway. The same with omnipotence. Well, have you read the opening chapters of Sefer Bereishit? Perhaps one can argue that God's omnipotence does not preclude the escape of evil to wreak havoc. The way I personally like to think of the non-traditional approach, as with a lot of these kind of more controversial viewpoints of Jewish philosophy, is not as the core levels of my belief, but they are good to have in the back pocket. If tomorrow, somehow, it was to be conclusively proven that God cannot see into the future, it wouldn't bother me. All we'd learn is that the Ralbag was correct. I don't walk around believing in Ralbag's view of omniscience. I want to make that very clear. And honestly, I don't think anyone should. But it's good to know that a very, very, very firm man who was a Rishon, who was a medieval authority, who was very much a respected rabbi, had a somewhat wacky view on these things. Sometimes it's good to know rabbis have wacky, you know, we've seen that, you know, you see this in even in the halachic world. There might be halachic positions we don't generally accept, normatively speaking, but in a specific situation, we suddenly start invoking them because that's what we need to do. Philosophically, you can do the same thing. And so, in some ways, the non-traditional approach is a very elegant solution to the problem of evil. It bats it away because all of a sudden we've redefined what omnipotence means. We've redefined what omniscience means, and now we can go ahead and be on our merry way. We've at least defended the notion that God can coexist with evil in this world, or evil can exist in a world that God is in control of. What I would also say, when it comes to trying to solve the problem of evil, you don't necessarily have to have a great answer. Your answer just needs to be slightly better than the Holocaust happened because of something someone did, like bad, like a sin someone did, which is the theodicy problem. These, at least, again, no one's going to go to sleep feeling better about themselves, thinking that God's omniscience doesn't mean what we think it means. But it's a better answer than theodicies. It still allows evil to exist. It doesn't quite paint blame, you know, upon so many people so easily. In some ways, it's a good answer. But I think the flaws in this approach are obvious. In part, it's in the name, the non-traditional approach. Ultimately, Ralbag's view of God's omniscience might help solve the problem of evil, but it creates shockwaves theologically in all other aspects of our Jewish lives. It goes back to Leonard's question. It goes back to Frank's question. It goes back to a lot of questions that were going through people's minds. If God can't see into the future, if God's omniscience doesn't allow him to have a plan, then sure, I can now have an answer to the problem of evil. But I've just raised 16,000 more questions instead. Same with omnipotence. Calling into question God's omnipotence is good. Okay, we've now, the idea that evil can get out through the back door when God's not looking is an elegant solution to the problem of evil, but it leads us to accept that evil can get out the back door when God's not looking, which raises other problems. Why isn't God watching the back door? And so, ultimately, you can't have a solution to the problem of evil that, to use a great cliche, throws out the baby with the bathwater. You can't solve, it's like the classic meme of, like, you know, a spider's in your house, so the only appropriate response is to burn the house down. It's not, that's not what you can do. To solve the problem of evil using the non-traditional approach, it's cool. It's really cool to rethink omniscience the way the Ralbag does. It's really cool to rethink omnipotence. But to basically pull the rug out from the entirety of Jewish theology in order to solve it is not a good way to go. It cannot be a good way to go. And so, ultimately, the non-traditional approach cannot be our satisfying approach to the problem of evil. It's a fascinating one, but a deeply unsatisfying one. We can't rethink the entirety of Jewish theology just to solve this problem. And so what we are going to talk about next week is an alternative solution, which, as we are going to see, is a far more traditional, or it fits far more within the realms of traditional responses. And it's probably one, in some ways, you've already heard of in many ways, but we're going to try and make it as philosophically rigorous as possible, which is the free will defense. And what we are actually going to start next week by doing is by taking a look at this problem of evil, but realizing that there is a third premise you can actually add into the entire problem that, by doing so, calls into question the conclusions, and that will hopefully provide us with, if not the answer to the problem of evil, then nonetheless, perhaps the most theologically satisfying of all the answers. But for that, we will have to wait until next week.